for argument, United States versus Griffin. Mr. Moorman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I may please the Court. Ryan Moorman for the appellant practicing under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711 through the Bloom Legal Clinic in Northwestern. Your Honors, Corey Griffin's conviction rests not on his intent to possess his father's hunting weapons over the three-week period in which he lived in his childhood home. Rather, it rests on a stretching of constructive possession law that stretched into uncharted territory and improper comments by the prosecutor that sought to compensate for the paltry evidence in this case. Turning first to the sufficiency claim, in order to succeed under its theory of constructive possession, the government was required to establish evidence to show the defendant knowingly had the power and the intention to exercise direction and control over the firearms. Now, this court, to show that the defendant intended to exercise control, this court requires a nexus that connects the defendant to the actual contraband. In looking at all of this court's constructive possession cases, this nexus is shown through some sort of something in the record.
You say connection rather than nexus, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you prefer connection instead of nexus?
I want to use a nice English word rather than a Latin word.
I prefer connection, too. And more importantly,
it's legal jargon.
The connection needs to be shown through some sort of plus factor. That's something in the record to which you can point to that shows that the defendant is connected to the actual contraband. Now, this is typically shown through evasive conduct, a gesture implying control, the defendant's items intermingled with the contraband, anything. And indeed, it's important to note the government accepts this framework. In its brief, it said that the defendant could live among firearms and have nothing to do with them. And without this plus factor, all that we're left with is proximity. And as this court has said, proximity does not speak to intent. Rather, proximity speaks only to the defendant's ability or his awareness to possess the contraband. And this awareness, this proximity, is only the knowledge aspect of constructive possession. It's not the intent element. And without that, this conviction cannot stand. And to a final point on the sufficiency argument, an important aspect of this case is that there's the minus factor in this case, and that is that the defendant's father's ownership, legal ownership of the firearms, explains their presence in the home. In other words, the fact that they're on the presence alone cannot show that the defendant intended to possess them. And as such, this importantly underscores the importance of showing something in addition to residence.
Wasn't there a witness who testified that your client told them that they were his?
Correct, Your Honor. Mario Walker, the confidential informant. Importantly, though, no matter how you arrange the myriad of contradictions within his testimony, no statement speaks to the gun for which the defendant was ultimately convicted, and that was the firearm behind the kitchen door. And as such, that's not a reason to affirm his conviction. Importantly, though, moving on to the prosecutorial misconduct claim, aware of the lack of evidence in this case, the prosecutor made several improper comments during closing argument to compensate for this lack of intent evidence. To the impropriety prong of prosecutorial misconduct.
What is the worst comment that he made?
The worst comment he made, Your Honor, is he urged the jury, he asked the jury rhetorically, what does your common sense tell you about someone with a serious criminal record? It tells you very much that he intended to possess this firearm.
So it's really the word serious that bothers you. He had to have they knew he had a criminal record. That's why he's a felon in possession. So,
no, No, Your Honor, it's not the... It's not.
Sorry, it's not. But...
Go ahead.
Well, he testified, right? Your client testified?
Correct.
Okay, so he could be impeached on his criminal convictions.
Correct.
It wasn't any secret.
Correct.
I looked at the comment, and it looked pretty ambiguous. It was an invitation to the jury to consider his criminal record. The judge presumably told the jury to consider with respect to credibility. So what's wrong with all that?
Well, it's not the fact that they knew he had a criminal record, but importantly, as this court recently held in Miller, which we filed a 28-J letter about, it's not the knowledge of it, but it's the way the prosecutor...
That's the word serious, right?
No, Your Honor, I disagree. It's not serious... serious.
You said criminal record, right?
No, Your Honor.
As Judge Hamilton said, the jury knew that already.
It's not relevant that the jury knows it. What's relevant here is the way...
The jury knows already, so... Not giving them new information.
Again, Your Honor, I point you to this court's opinion in Miller, in which the fact that there was a similar felon in possession case in which the jury knew the defendant had a criminal record, but this court stated that it's not the fact that they know it, it's the way the prosecutor uses it. So if the prosecutor said, and recall, the defendant in this case has a serious criminal record, that would be proper. They could use that for credibility. But that's not what the prosecutor did in this case. The prosecutor told the jury that their common sense tells you the defendant intends to possess firearms. And this is the precise sort of propensity argument that 404B prohibits, and in which this court overturned the defendant's conviction in Miller. In addition...
I thought your better argument was that the prosecution misstated the evidence with respect to Perry's testimony. Or was that the name of the probation officer?
Yes, correct.
That there was no evidence that she ever told Griffin he could not be in a household that had guns in it.
Correct.
And I thought the prosecution stated quite clearly the opposite.
Many times. And in addition, he continued that into his brief. And it's not a matter of what argument is best. I think that all of these claims speak to the
just to get back to a moment to this serious criminal record. The government had to prove the criminal record, didn't it?
No, Your Honor.
It's not a felon in possession.
Correct. And again, I think
so
it's...
That's an element. Now, since that is an element of the crime, why can't the government say... What if the government said, look, why do we have a felon in possession law? Because we worry that people with a criminal record are are more likely to misuse firearms than other people. Now, would there be anything wrong with saying that to a jury?
There's a question as to whether he's...
Would there be anything wrong with saying that to a jury? This is why we have these felon possession laws. We worry about felons using or being in a position, you know, the constructive possession, where they could use a gun.
I think there would be a problem with that because he's not presenting the evidence and asking the jury to deliberate.
What's wrong with explaining to a jury the purpose of a law?
Regardless, Your Honor, that's not, again, I want to emphasize that that's not what happened in this case.
I thought your concern was with his characterizing the record as serious. But apparently that's not what bothers you.
No, Your Honor, because, of course, that is a problem, because previously it was an unnamed, and that's old chief, that says the fact that you've stipulated to it, you can't then, it's not fair game. So that is relevant, I would agree, Your Honor.
But when he testifies, all that comes in anyway. Right.
It does, for impeachment purposes.
Yeah.
But one more time, it's the use of it. It's the use to say that proves intent when that was not a permissible use of that evidence. And that invited the jury to convict him on something other than the evidence presented in this case. Furthermore, he bolstered this with the ex-smoker comment in which he contrasted the defendant with an ex-smoker who perhaps can benevolently take...
Would it be wrong for the government to say... That his felony involved drug dealing, and we know that drug dealers could present evidence. The drug dealers are very It's a type of criminal activity which very often involves use of guns.
No, Your Honor, that would have been inappropriate based on this court's holding in Miller. The fact that he committed a crime unrelated to the crime before this court 8 years ago says nothing about his intent to possess the weapon approximately 8 years later at trial. That's the precise sort of argument we're making here, is that that's a propensity argument.
It's not probative.
I'm saying that the prior convictions were not admitted for the purpose of showing intent. The prosecutor didn't even attempt to admit them for that purpose. And because of that, he can't use them during closing for that purpose. But more importantly, had he attempted to admit them for that purpose, in all likelihood, the district court would have denied that. So he didn't even give the district court an opportunity to pass on that.
You're into your rebuttal time.
I just want to make one more quick. Thank you, Judge. To the prejudice prong, it's important to note that this court's opinion in Miller, which, again, was very similar to this case, noted that the improper use of prior bad acts to show intent was very prejudicial, even when the government's case was strong. And in Miller, the evidence was much stronger than it was in this case. So having shown impropriety, it follows that the improper use of that evidence was prejudicial in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mormon. Mr. Ingraham?
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Ingram. I'm an assistant United States attorney with the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I was the lawyer for the government in the district court. Your Honor, the evidence...
You have a really weak case. This is the weakest such case I've ever seen. The fellow goes to live with his father, which is a natural thing to do for a person in his situation. The father is something of a gun nut, you know, but it's for hunting. It's fine. These are guns for hunting. They're not pistols. And the government somehow picks out one of these guns, a shotgun, and says, oh, this... They had constructive possession of that? I don't get that. I don't really see. I think you're just confusing access with possession. You're saying if a felon is in a place where there is a gun, then he constructively possesses it.
Judge, that's not.
You have no other evidence except access.
That's not our case.
What do you have besides access as evidence?
We had the fact that the house had been cleared of guns several years earlier, because this same defendant had been convicted of an offense, and so there was knowledge. He had knowledge that he was.
Look, that's access. His father is a hunter and has all these guns, and he moves in with his father. Now maybe he moved in with his father so he could be near the guns, not so that he could live cheap. But you don't have any evidence of that,
Your Honor. What
proof beyond a reasonable doubt? I don't see anything.
What the defendant's experience showed from the fact that the father's guns were cleared from the house after a prior conviction was that he was not to be around firearms.
Well, that's not what the law says. What evidence do you have that he was told that?
It wasn't that he was told that. It's that he experienced it. And he admitted during his testimony that he was aware that the guns had been taken from the home because of his problems with the law. And so the evidence was that knowing that he was not to be around firearms as a convicted felon.
Well, that's not the law.
That's not constructive. Being around firearms is not constructive possession.
It may be prudent, very prudent. When I took guilty pleas, I'd always tell people, in essence, you're taking a chance if you're ever around guns, but the law doesn't prohibit being around guns.
Right, but the inference that we asked the jury to draw was, and the jury accepted it with respect to the one gun and one.
Why that gun?
Because it was the most readily available gun, Your Honor, of all the ones that were there. The defendant testified that he used the kitchen. This was a firearm that was. There were other firearms in the kitchen as well as the one that the jury found. But the
one I know. How did they pick? How did they pick that one?
Because it was the most.
Anyway, why the kitchen? What difference does it make?
Because that's the.
It's under his father's pillow. His father isn't in the room all the time.
But the gun that the jury found and the ammunition that's
totally arbitrary. Look,
actually, it was not arbitrary.
If the defendant wants to use a gun in the drug business or something else, he will take the gun which is most appropriate for use in the drug business. If that happens to be under his father's pillow, he'll wait till his father is out of the house, then he'll take the gun and then he'll replace it.
Why do you think they picked this single gun?
As I said in my brief, Your Honor, I believe they chose the gun that they chose as well as the ammunition that they chose because of the array of guns and ammunition. These were the most readily available items.
To him, he goes past it regularly?
Yeah. Well, yes, he went. He acknowledged that he knew that the ammunition was there.
He acknowledged he knew the gun was there.
He did not admit that he knew the gun was there.
Where was the gun specifically?
The gun was behind a door leading to the staircase off the kitchen, and he said that he was in the kitchen regularly.
Where was the nearest gun to that gun?
The next nearest gun were a series of guns that were between the refrigerator and the wall in
so
that.
Why were they less accessible to him than the one behind the door to the basement or whatever it was?
They weren't necessarily less accessible, Your Honor, but they were less visible, and so it was.
So you charged his knowledge of that and possession of those guns as well, and the jury didn't buy that.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. We charged each of the firearms and all of the ammunition that was in the house on the theory that he knew that he wasn't supposed to be around them, and knowing that, his failure to separate
was fine in the sense that he obviously knew about the guns next to the refrigerator as well as the others, right? He knew about them all. That's your theory.
That was our theory. The jury didn't buy it.
What earthly basis could they have had for singling out that gun over the other guns in the kitchen?
Because it was the most readily available.
Well, what do you mean? Did he even know about the ones between the refrigerator and the stove or whatever you said they were?
Because
so here's a refrigerator. Now, where's the gun?
The other guns.
Where are they?
Refrigerator guns are between the side of the refrigerator and the wall, so they're less readily visible.
Didn't you say that he had said he knew about the gun?
He knew that the guns had been cleared from the house.
Did he say he knew that the gun that they ultimately relied on, the jury relied on?
He did not acknowledge that gun, Your Honor. In fact, he said, I did not. What he did acknowledge was ammunition on the stairs. He did not acknowledge knowledge of any of the firearms.
But from your point of view, he had to pass that gun regularly.
That's correct. And so the likelihood, the way to interpret the jury's verdict is that.
What was the gun between the refrigerator and the wall? What was that?
I believe there were three long guns between the refrigerator and the wall.
Rifles?
Shotguns, I believe.
And the gun that you're talking about was
also a shotgun.
Shotgun.
Yes. So our theory, Your Honors, was this defendant knew he was not to be around guns as a convicted felon.
You keep saying that. That's your basic fallacy. You think that for a felon to be in an area, to be living in a house in which there's a gun, means that he has the intention to exercise control over it. That's your whole...
If he knows from his past experience that by virtue of his felony, the police are going to come and clear out the firearms if they know that they're there, his failure to say, these guns are here, take them out, is an indication of his will.
Your theory really seems... He's supposed to tell his father, what? You can't have guns. You're lawful. You're a hunter. You can't have guns because I'm living here. That's
probation officer.
If he doesn't do that, it proves that he wanted to use the guns.
That's a reasonable inference, Your Honor.
Certainly not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
The probation officer...
Suppose he just can't afford to live anywhere else, right? What is he supposed to do?
The father's supposed to clear the guns out of the house.
Well, how can he make his father obviously loves his guns. He has so many guns. He loves them.
and he loves his son. Combinations.
Yeah.
The probation officer explained to the father, prior to the son coming back to live at the house, that there were to be no firearms in the house. The father knew from his previous experience.
He can't forbid the father to have guns in his house. Probation officer doesn't have that power.
But the probation officer has the power to say that's not a fitting residence for this person to go and live.
So that the probation officer can decide, say you cannot live there under the terms of probation. If there are guns in the house, you can't live there.
The probation officer told the father there cannot be guns there.
Judge Bauer's question.
Can he tell the defendant, you cannot live in a house with guns? Can he say that?
I don't believe the probation officer said that to this defendant.
No, I know, but I want to know, as a matter of law, can a probation officer designate where you live as being inappropriate because there are guns?
In my experience, probation officers have done that. I believe probation officers can do that.
Okay. They have the legal power to do that? Wouldn't it have to be a term of probation? Wouldn't it have to be a term in the probation order saying that your residence will be determined by your probation officer?
In my experience, Your Honor, probation officers have deemed...
What is the law? Does a probation officer have the power to designate a person's residence, even though there's nothing in the probation order or in the sentence that authorizes him to do so? That's a simple question. The answer, obviously, is no, right?
The probation officer told...
That the probation officer doesn't have the legal power to tell this guy where to live unless it's in the sentence. The sentence could say that. It's a condition of probation. You have to live wherever the probation officer tells you. Now, that's not in the sentence, is it?
It is not.
No. And it's not the inherent authority of probation officers that even if it's not mentioned in the sentence, they can tell the probationer where to live.
I'm sure that's correct,
right.
Your Honor. Your Honors, I ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Mr. Ingram, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions, if
I
could.
Certainly.
Is it correct that your theory is that essentially any occupant of any home that it's a reasonable inference that any occupant of any home has the power and intent to control any object that he knows is there?
No, that's not the theory, Your Honor. The theory in this case is that this defendant, based on his experience, knows that he's not to be around firearms.
We've gone through that, and that's not what the law says. So why doesn't your theory extend as far as I've just suggested?
This defendant knew he was not to be around firearms, and his failure.
We're not getting through, obviously. Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Knew that he was not to be around, right? That's your probation officer argument again, that somehow it was illegal for him to be living there.
It's not in the terms of his probation. It's not in the terms of federal law. Both of those speak of possession, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ingram. Do you have anything more, Mr. Moorman?
You want to be careful. What's going on?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You had on points, but go ahead. Do whatever you wanted.
I just wanted to correct one foot or clarify the record. The probation officer, although regardless of whether she had the legal force to tell the defendant where she lived, she affirmatively approved the decision to live in the residence.
Without knowing there were guns all over the place. I mean, to go back to Judge Posner's question about the purpose of this law a few minutes ago.
Sure.
Would you agree that when Mr. Griffin was sitting in the kitchen, he was about 1 second away from violating 922 G1?
Correct. But that doesn't speak to anything as to whether he intended to violate it, which, as you pointed out, I thought during Appellee's argument, there was no evidence of that intent, and that's what the law penalizes.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and we thank you and the Northwestern Clinic for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. Ingram as well.